Welcome to our first meeting of the Community Wellbeing Scrutiny of 2023. And a particular welcome to those people who I haven't met and don't know what your names are. So if we can get started. So item one on the agenda, minutes of the 17th of November 2022. As previously published on the council's website. Is everyone agreeable to the minutes?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I'm going to ask Councillor Pearce to sign off the minutes because, of course, the Chair wasn't at the meeting.
Thank you, Councillor Pearce. Item two, apologies.
None received, Chair.
Thank you. Item three, public question time.
That's nil.
Councillor session time.
That's nil.
And item five, members' items. Okay, no members' items.
There is, Chair, on page four, it is the Health and Care Wellbeing Scrutiny Committee report to notes, Chair.
Thank you. Do we note the report?
Noted, Chairman.
Thank you. So we're moving on to 7A, page 10 to 64, air quality annual status report, and I believe the contact officer is Neil Clifton and
Gillian McCullough.
Thank you, Gillian. Would you like to give the report?
I'm the non-expert of the two. These reports, just to be clear for everybody, I'm Neil Clifton, interim head of operations.
Could you speak up just a little bit, Neil?
Sure, yeah, I'm interim head of operations, Neil Clifton. These four reports, I understand they're always brought to this committee on an annual basis, so they should be reasonably familiar to you in terms of the broad content, but I'll take you through them nevertheless. So, the first one, air quality. This is a report which basically is to inform members that what the council does basically in terms of monitoring air quality in the borough for reasons of maintaining good health and quality of life. We have an annual air quality status report for 2022, which is reference to that at paragraph 3.2. The why we do it is that this is a statutory requirement of government. DEFRA basically require local authorities to carry out an annual assessment of air quality in their area. We're required to compare the findings of that assessment against nationally recognised standards. We then have to report those findings back to government. And in the event that there are any issues, then significant issues of air quality, then we have to declare what are called air quality management areas. You'll be pleased to know that in the Boroughs case, our status report shows that we don't have any such deficits. Significant areas of air quality issues that we've identified in monitoring is really in the M6 corridor, certain locations on the M6 corridor, but not at the level that requires designation of an air quality management area. And we are pretty confident that since the smart motorway status has been implemented through from junction 13 up to 15, that has actually improved. Obviously, it's increased the capacity of the M6 with the fourth lane, but also for those of you who travel up and down the motorway, you'll note from time to time that the advisory speed limit comes in at, say, 60 miles an hour, and part of the agenda for that is not only to manage congestion, but also to improve air quality in particular areas. So if we were able to be in a situation where air quality, again, you may find in other areas of the country, if you drive through particularly dense or congested areas, you may often find an advisory speed limit which is specifically targeted at managing air quality or improving air quality. I think the only other real point to, two points of nature. One is, you'll be aware that there's significant growth arisen in the borough over the past decade and further growth planned over the next decade. Particularly with the advent of HS2. The borough has been very ambitious with its growth plans. So we will continue to monitor air quality as those growth plans go forward. And during the environmental health colleagues, consulted as part of the Northern Town planning process and require air quality information as part of any normal large-scale planning application proposals. The only other point I want to draw out, Chair, is that DEFRA also looks to local authorities to see what else we're doing to manage or improve air quality. You'll see reference in the report there to the fact that we've been promoting the installation of electrical vehicle charging in a number of our car parks. So there's installations in several locations and there are further installations planned over the next 12 months. Back to taking questions, Chair.
Yes, I have a question for you. On page 18, the very last paragraph says, in the near future, HS2 construction will also significantly alert traffic flows. The work in stone on the railhead has been brought forward 18 months and the it's imminent. We don't have a date, but I am extremely concerned about the amount of HGVs which will be coming down Yarnfield Lane onto the A34. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if there are any plans to actually... Oh, that's nice, isn't it? You know, if there are any plans to monitor the air quality in that particular area.
I'll hand over to you in a second. What I can say to you is we have to process formal what are called Section 61 applications, where HS2 are required to submit a portfolio of information that describes their approach to engineering works in specific areas, and that includes a whole suite of documentation that addresses air quality, noise, potential noise nuisance and so on. We have to approve those proposals and then we monitor as we go along effectively as those particular engineering works are implemented.
So can I just ask then, as you've said that, and excuse my scathing tone, due to the my experience with them and monitoring their incompetence, do they deliver the reports?
They do send them through, yeah. My colleague Sean is the one that's heading up the Section 61 part of it there. So he's the one that's leading on that and is reviewing the applications that they come through to us. So we do go through them with the faculty to make sure that they're up to scratch and what we want for that area then, because as you say, we don't want to have any issues. So we are looking at it.
Thank you, Gillian. Now, does the committee want to go through this page by page, or do you want
bad
to...
enough reading before the meeting.
Well, in that case, then, how does everybody feel if you ask your questions? Okay, Anne,
okay, I just wondered on page 22, if you'd explain the graph, really.
I think we've been very lucky with these papers. There's only a few where you cannot read the print, even with 12 pairs of glasses on.
I just thought, well, it looked as if it was going up, it was increasing, but I wasn't really sure because it wasn't very...
That's it, is it the nitrogen, sorry, it says NO2 concentration for NPL fields. So there's two colours on the graph. The round circles are for the reference values, and then the blue boxes are for the laboratory mean concentration. And then there's a box plot either side, so it's showing you the deviation between the values as well. So it's going across with the month of exposure for 2021. And then, let me see if I can get the... The values that the staff sideways laboratory mean, it looks like they're taking their values from other places then during those months because they are higher than we're reading. In Stafford we haven't got anything that's anywhere near 60. they're all well below that, so yeah, I wouldn't be able to say anything more than that.
So that's not accurate then.
I'd have to check with the figures then. so they should be somewhere else in here.
Because it does say later on, in I'm not sure where it says it now, it's talking about particulate matter.
Yeah.
They aren't actually measured in the stratosphere.
No, it's not a requirement to measure those. Nitrogen dioxide is what the focus is on. You can decide to measure for a particular, but it requires different pieces of equipment and they're very expensive. Right. So if there's not an issue, there's no likelihood to be an issue with particulate in an area if you don't need to measure for it. So it'd be something that'd be historical. So some of the boroughs, so I know that Newcastle used to measure for particular over a number of years and then found that there was no issue and then didn't measure for it over the next few years there. So I'm guessing
they are now
in Newcastle.
Yeah. And I think that's arisen because they have had to declare air quality management areas.
Right. So we haven't got any of the air quality management areas here. We only need to legally measure the nitrogen dioxide levels. We don't need to look at particulate matter.
Okay, Tony?
Well, it was on that issue that I wanted to raise a point. On page 30, according to the table there, around 1 in 20 deaths are in Staffordshire are attributable to particulate pollution.
Which page was it, 30 or
30?
25 and 30, I think it says.
Well, yes,
page 30.
We've got the table showing estimated percentage number of deaths by local authority area, attributable.
It's 2.3.2.
So the percentage of deaths is...
Yeah, 5 to 6%. So in Stafford it's 5.7,
yeah.
Yes?
Yeah.
So that's 1 in 20 deaths.
Yeah.
Directly attributable, according to this, to particulate pollution. So, you know, I'm not criticising the department particularly, but the fact that it isn't seen as a priority by government, I think is very concerning.
Yes. Yeah.
With that high level of deaths directly attributable to it. Could well have this wrong, but I understood last time we had this report that we were told that Stafford was going to start measuring it. Now, I don't know if others recollect that at all, but that was certainly my recollection. Of course, the officer in charge then isn't here now. But you say that there are no plans now.
We don't need to measure it at the moment. I can certainly check for you if that was what was told to yourselves last time.
I think perhaps to rephrase that, we don't legally need to measure it at the moment. It would be more appropriate.
I think through the chair, obviously what the table seeks to represent is to demonstrate that along with Newcastle, we're the lowest level. I appreciate that still, as you say, around 1 in 20 deaths, but compared to the county percentage and the England figure, we are within both of those benchmarks.
Yeah, that's an estimate though, Stafford 5.7%. That's just a guesstimate, if you like. Because we're not.
Yeah, so that's come from Public Health England, so they're the ones that would collect that kind of data then, and that's the data that we used for this table. So they're the ones that piece things together like that.
Okay, Ray.
Thank you, Jamie. Yeah, I think, first of all, my congratulating on the report. It certainly takes some reading. A couple of points, yeah, the graph that was mentioned earlier, is for 2021. That's a long time ago. And I just wondered how often it's reviewed and updated. I mean, this is for the year.
Yeah.
Can't we have a report more often
we can try and get something to you more often, but it's worth it's better to have it over a year's span, so that, because there's trends in data.
Right,
so the levels of nitrogen dioxide vary over the year. So you'll typically generally have higher levels at one point and lower at another. So if we were just focusing on, say, the first 6 months, it would skew the data. So it would either show you that you were having higher levels at that point or lower than you would if you took it at the 12-year average then.
Okay.
So it would give you a good picture of what's going on.
Mm. This is up to August anyway, isn't it? So it just seems a long while ago.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
So out of date. It's,
through the chair, I think it's fair to say these reports would have originally, were originally programmed to come to you, was it in November?
November, I think, yes.
But some of you may recall Lisa Harvey, who was the previous service manager, left the organisation, I think it was the end of October. Basically, the process of her leaving and just picking up the slack, the report slipped a cycle. So, ordinarily, we will be with you in the autumn cycle, so slightly earlier. This has probably been delayed by 2 months or so.
And regarding the information, the percentages shown on page 30, I think it indicates, well, it's great to see that we are one of the low ones. I think the fact that the M6 runs right through Staffordshire,
yeah.
Is an indicator of there's going to be a problem anyway, because if you live close to the motorway, it's how we address that is what you're trying to achieve now, and hopefully that will improve over the years. But it's good to see that we're actually 5.7 and the lowest.
Andy.
Thanks, Chair. Just a reflection on numbers again. it's interesting to see the Stafford is 0.3% higher than the Morelands, and I'm assuming the Morelands has got a fairly low density of both traffic and population relative to Stafford itself. So if we are pretty well comparable with the Morelands as a town, that's not bad. However, what worries me is the fact that these are estimated percentage number of deaths. Now, given the difficulty of measuring deaths in COVID, the chances of getting these anything like right and knowing what was causing the deaths, and it makes me smile when somebody says it's an estimated percentage of 5.7.
Who knows?
It's an estimate of 5.73594.
Yeah. Estimated.
Yeah. Vic Reeves said most statistics are made up 6-7% of the time.
Dear me, I don't know what he's suggesting.
No, seriously, we're putting. I would about putting great weight on these numbers, given that they're estimates and the difficulty in getting these estimates to 0.1% of the point.
Yeah.
An observation.
Yeah, that's it.
Thank you, Andy. Could I ask page 34, number 5, Longton Road, Stone? How come we've got 0 to distant to relevant exposure and distance to curb?
Double check for you. We tend to put 0 when something's on the diffusion tubes on the facade of a property, because it's where you're going to be exposed to it then if you live in there. I'll double check on that one. It might be a type of
testing. I did wonder that. Okay, thank you, Gillian. Do we have any more questions on this very lengthy and detailed report? Tony? Oh, I'm sorry, Angela. Yes, go ahead, Angela. I didn't realise you wanted to.
I just wanted to comment and say, you know, that the maps are not really terribly helpful, are they?
No.
And you can't even see a street or a landmark, so like a... You know, there's it's near 6.2 and all of these maps. I think that's maybe a least strategic thing to say.
Okay.
I mean, what we could do, Chair, if you wanted to have, go the other way, we would need more paper. What we could do is a zoomed in view so you can see at street level precisely where
that may be a bit more helpful, but as it is, if you look at that map, it tells me absolutely nothing.
Yeah, that's not a problem. We can do that for you.
Or even if you had all these, if you had some something at the bottom that told you what that three means and what the 22, if you knew what they were pointing to.
Yes, no problem doing that now, Bill.
There is a clue on page 46 where it says tit, so I presume that's Tittenser. But I'm lost on the rest.
Presumably that's Tittenser.
Yeah. Well, I hope so, Angela.
I need to see the end of Clunkin' Suggested. That's what all these other numbers, what they mean to us. It's just not very helpful. I'm going back again to the graphs. Maybe if you even knew what we were trying to look at in the graphs, because they've got a similar graph page 43. Whenever you print that off to look at, please tell me anything, because you don't even know what these symbols are meant to be. It doesn't tell you.
Bit more explanation.
Yeah, can we read that?
Okay. There's no explanation whatsoever. And I just feel well. Either cut down in the paper and just come and talk to us.
Yeah.
Rather than.
Okay.
Say, just to sit and read this, I don't know if you've read it yourself or if you just bought it from somebody.
Oh, no.
I'm sure you've read it. I'm sure.
Yeah, I'm sure you have.
Tony.
Thank you. Page 54. This is listing measures that are being taken to try and reduce the uncertainty. One of them is anti-idling enforcement and traffic management. And sorry to go back to the predecessor, but he did, in conjunction actually with the local U3A, undertake, and one of the local schools, undertake research on the effect of parents sitting in cars with the engines running. It was shown that there was a significant effect. And I would have hoped that we would have been taking some action, but according to this, we're not.
No, I think because of COVID, we've been way late, unfortunately, to do some more proactive work on things like that. And so it's definitely something that we want to be involved with going forward.
Good. I'm very pleased to hear that.
It is a really big task, isn't it, if we think of how many schools we've got. And I know my local primary school, stand there in the morning, I'm queuing to take my grandson in, and the amount of cars that have got their engines running and is just ridiculous. And they probably are the ones that will squeal the loudest about, carbon footprint, etc. Andy?
Yeah, on the same subject. We've got a no action moment because of COVID, but it's coming. What sort of action will we take? Because one of my parish councils, it's a constant battle with this issue of idling cars outside of school and residents complaining about it.
Yeah.
What sort of measures will we be taking?
Yeah, so we'd have to go out and assess and see what the conditions are there, what the situation is that's going on.
Will you be measuring them?
We can do, yeah. It depends what kind of monitoring we were looking at. You can have some handheld monitors. We could look to put something in place in front of the school.
Mm.
I know that there's also works that are going on with county, that there's a team that are going into different primary schools as well to look at similar issues. So it might be more teaming up with people like that then.
So if this particular school wanted some action to take hold, the parish council, will they apply directly to yourselves?
If they want to get in touch with us, yes.
Yeah.
We can talk with them then about the different things that we could look to do with them. That's not a problem.
Just on generally the yeah.
There are a number of schools with air monitors, so it might be worth asking if you can have one for your school.
Mm. Thank you,
Gillian. Are we okay now with the report? No more questions? Thank you very much for that report, though. And moving on to page 65, the food safety annual report, which I think is both of you again.
Okay. Thank you. So this is a report which we're required to prepare by the Food Standards Agency. The Food Standards Agency have a code of practice against which we undertake our free rising rating work, and Essentially, this report highlights the job of work we do to maintain high standards of food safety through a combination of inspection, sampling, and enforcement. And of course, most members and members of the public, for that matter, I suppose, would be easily recognise the food hygiene rating scheme, the numbers, the scores on doors, as we very often call it. It's one of those that I often rue the day I went into an Indian restaurant in North Wales and spotted the one rating, and I came out rather than when I went in. But there we go. Anyway, so the context for this report, there are three key elements to it. First is the service plan, which you approved back in 2018. That's the plan which runs from 2018 to 2021, and that basically explains to the Food Standards Agency how food safety services will be delivered over that 3-year period. So it explains our processes, our systems, our capacity, our resources, and the approach to the work programme. Then we produce an annual report, which is a backward look at how we delivered services in the previous financial year, in this case 2021-22. And then there's a forward look in the form of an action plan, 2022-23, i.e. the current year that we're in, which basically seeks to respond to the issues that were highlighted in the annual report and to ensure delivery of the approved service plan. The other element, which we'll come on to as a separate report, Chair, is the food safety service plan for 22-25. That's the next item. Mm-hmm. But that's in terms of the purpose of the report at the headline level, Chair. Happy to take any questions.
Thank you. Does anyone have any questions on the food safety annual report? Tony?
Thank you. Well, on the... It's, it's the statistics given, yeah. It's actually on page 67, first page of the appendix. Two questions. First of all, you state there are currently 4 professional full-time equivalent posts. How does that compare with previous years?
I wouldn't know, I'm afraid.
Short out, I probably wouldn't know either. My understanding is that we, in terms of staffing levels within the team, compared to our the family average of authorities of our kind of size, we're, I think, lower than the average in terms of headlines, but in terms of productivity and delivery of service, we deliver in accordance with the Food Standards Agency requirements. So hopefully that demonstrates efficiency and competence in the team, rather than necessarily a shortage of capacity.
Okay, thank you. Secondly, figures are given for number of establishments and so on, requests received, etc. I think it would have been helpful to see how this compared again with previous years.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah. No comment.
Okay, can I ask a question? Page 70, FS6. Performance measure. It says reduction in phone through from contact centre. Could you explain what that means, please?
Okay, so that's basically trying to get what we call right first time service delivery. So hopefully, by investing effort and time in website, we can promote self help. So this is basically that every time a phone call reaches an officer, they're distracted from their work programme. So it's about where we can. Using a combination of methods to get information out to stakeholders and interested parties so they can access that information 24 hours a day, but it's principally through our website.
So does that mean that you envisage stopping phone calls?
No, not at all. No. If a stakeholder, member of the public or whoever has a call that requires a response, that either the information isn't in an intelligible fashion or they can't interpret information on our website or through all the sources, then officers are available to take the calls.
Good, thank you. Thank you, Neil.
It's about, I suppose, trying to reach. I remember some years ago working with a consultant who observed the static, it was actually a planning officer rather than an environmental health officer, but the principle was really important. We were trying to look at why the service wasn't particularly productive, and that particular officer was interrupted 20 times in a 1 4-hour slot on a typical day, and I think historically environmental health colleagues have found similar issues. that where direct dial phone numbers weren't made available, there was a lot of disruption of staff and they simply couldn't get on and do the work that they're required to do. So this is about trying as far as possible to get information out there in a digestible and easily interpreted fashion for self-help, so that then only essential calls come through to officers. But certainly there's no intention here to actively reduce calls that are necessary.
Call me old-fashioned, but that tells me there wasn't enough staff. it concerns me about those who are not in the digital age, that they want a welcoming voice, a warm tone, rather than be directed automatically to a website.
Well, hopefully what they will get, Chair, is they'll get an officer in the contact centre who at first port of call will endeavour to answer the inquiry if it's a straightforward one, but will then put the call through to a technically qualified officer if it's necessary.
That sounds very good to me. I don't know about the rest of the committee. Ray?
Yeah, just one question, please, and that is on page 67. You talk about the overview showing broadly compliant establishments, 76.4, which means nearly 25% of the establishments are below satisfactory, is that right? Or?
So, yeah, broadly compliant is
It's all right. I smiled because I actually asked the question of Jill.
Yeah.
Is that a phrase? Because that phrase left me a little bit uncomfortable. Broadly compliant.
Broadly. Yeah.
It is a phrase that apparently the FSA recognised.
Yeah. It's taken from their code of conduct, and their guidance is broadly compliant as well. Someone's rated a 3, so it's anything that's less than that would be not broadly compliant. So that's where they're meeting most of the requirements that we ask of them.
Right. And what happens if they don't action?
We've got a staged way that we deal with things then. So we try and do informal action first. We revisit if there's something not playing ball. Then we have a whole host of different notices that we could use. We try and get people to do the work that we might need them to do through that. And then ultimately, if they don't comply, then it would be prosecution. So it's a staged enforcement that we use then.
I think sometimes it's something as simple as paperwork not being filled in.
Sometimes it is. For them to be rated one or two, it tends to be far more than that. But yeah, paperwork does carry a bigger score then. So if their paperwork isn't good, they get scored really more than for that.
Andy, sorry, Ray, I thought you'd finished up.
Does it tend to be more hygiene and less rodent? Because I noticed the reason I ask is there was an article in the paper about Westminster and the mice have been resistant to the poison, and they're everywhere. And I'll be honest with you, I was having dinner at Westminster one night.
Oh, you named
in the in the, in the dining room, and a bloody mouse ran across. They're everywhere. With rodents becoming more resistant, is it a big problem with food establishments or?
Touch wood, not so far. It tends to be more of the hygiene and hand sanitizers, one of those you want to say out loud because tomorrow I'll come into something different.
All right, thanks,
Andy.
Keep making it sound like an episode of Faulty Towers. the start scores on the doors, is it compulsory?
Yes.
That they show this? So if they've got a one or a two, they've got to show it. I'd be happy to show a 5-star. Show my 1-star.
It's on the FSA website, on there. And I know places like Deliveroo and Just Eat delivery services like that, then they need to have establishments have a 3 or above before they can be on that. So that's at the moment that's encouraging an awful lot of places to up their game, and if they have had a poor score, because it means that they can't use those platforms to make more business sense there.
Is it that, I mean, following up, so what you're saying is, I guess, that it's not compulsory to show scores on the doors?
So they are encouraged to.
and we'd like them to.
Not compulsory. Is a short answer.
And that's a national policy. That's not a borough policy.
It's different in Wales. Wales, it is compulsory for most
of
But yeah, in England, it's not compulsory at the moment. But it's one of those where if you go and eat somewhere and they haven't got a score on the door, you do wonder. So we do try and encourage them.
And you can check via which, apart from delivery, to which website?
The Food Standards Agency.
Food Standards. Mm.
I was very surprised today to see one of the establishments in Stowe, which provides hospitality and food, was just absolutely over the moon displaying their five stars.
I think
to myself, if I'm going into somewhere, I want you to have five stars anyway, you know. But I thought it was lovely that they'd chosen to show everybody on Facebook.
I'm just thinking, you know, how many places have we shut down in the last 18 months? Have we shut any down?
Not since
what's the criteria to get to that? I mean, if we've only got one star, you know.
That's it. That's where, but if they've been awarded one star, then there's obviously works that need to be done. So that's where the enforcement criteria comes in. That's to say, trying to inform one if they don't action that, then it's notices. If they don't do that, then it's prosecution. Ultimately, it could be closure. Where there is an immediate risk to health then and an officer is out visiting, then we can ask them to close voluntarily, or we can force them to close. So we do have that ability.
Right.
But we always try and work with the businesses then to try and get them on board to do it.
So you've got the authority to close them temporarily?
Yes,
So we have you to thank, your department, and I say thank you sincerely, that in Staffordshire, the Stafford Borough, we can go out and eat with confidence and know that we're not going to be very poorly. So thank you. Any more questions? We okay? Right, can we move on to the food safety service plan then, please, Neil?
So this is the, I did refer to this briefly in my intro, this is the food safety plan for the next, food safety service plan for the next 3 years, following from the one that we approved in 2018. It's set out in six chapters, which I won't go through in detail. The first bit, a little bit of corporate context. The main section is really of greatest interest, we suspect, is section two or chapter two, which sets a little bit of background, explains the scope of the service and our approach for service delivery, our resourcing, and so on and so forth. In section three or chapter three, there's information there about how we performance manage delivery of the service, the performance indicators. In chapter four, there's a review of the work programme, which again explains our approach to service delivery in the context of preparing the annual report that I referred to in the last item. Then we set out the work programme in chapter five. You'll see reference in there to Annex 2, which I think when the report was originally drafted, we had an Annex 2 which, for reasons of simplification, we redrafted it and just simply put some narrative in. So apologies for the error that stayed in the report. On page 91, so at the top of page 91, it says that Annex 2 sets out the key service tasks for 2022-23. If you scroll then through to page 92, that sets out the immediate plans and long-range plans in simple bullet point format. I think previously there was a separate appendix document which was deleted in place of nothing in this place. So again, Chair, happy to take any questions. So this one's more about that forward look and more descriptive of our approach, but again, happy that either Jill or I can attempt to answer any questions.
Yeah, Angela.
Thank you, Chair. On page 83, you tell us of the number of registered food premises. Are we actually talking there? Page 83 is down to sort of the second last paragraph on page 1392, registered food premises. Are you actually talking about establishments that sell food, for example, supermarkets or shops? You're not including other premises where food is available there, are you? what I'm actually thinking of is there are schools and there are nurseries and nursing homes, etc., who provide food.
So
but they're not included in that figure there, are they, the 1392?
I think they probably are included in that figure because they class as food
only
business.
Retail shops that are selling more or less to the public.
Certainly, from my recollection, so this was a question I asked when the report was drafted. I looked at the, probably what would be helpful, those figures above, where we've got the scores on the doors, 712 premises with a rating of 5, etc. When I totaled that up, I assumed it would come to 1392, and it didn't.
Quite
so I thought, well, why is that then? And the answer came back, well, actually, it's because that the 1392 includes food premises, for example, the newsagents that sell sweets and bottles of milk in the fridge and so on and so forth.
Yeah, but so what I'm thinking of through you, Chair, again, is where do we get details about the other premises, as I said to you, the likes of schools where sometimes the meals are prepared on premise, or in the nurseries, or as I say, in the nursing homes, or the likes of that, hotels, etc. Where are those figures? Because presumably they must be checked for.
They're not part of the five-star rating scheme, but
they are inspected. And where do we get the information about inspections that are carried out on there? I didn't see any reference to these other premises that provide food.
We can break it down for you if you'd like into different categories of establishment.
I think it might be interesting to know because there must be other premises, schools and nurseries and nursing homes and other, because that won't include restaurants, that 1502, does it?
Would it be useful for us to break it down into those groups for you?
Yes,
that's
it would.
Yeah,
I'm sure that's what we
see that, because I know that we do have shops with your newsagents, your corner shop, etc., your garages, who all sell food. I'm thinking of where are we getting a breakdown of the health and safety in these other establishments, or are you not looking at them at all? The hotels, the pubs, the places that are providing meals to us.
Yeah, that's not a problem. That all of those places are inspected. We can certainly break it down into different groups for you.
I think it would. I do think it would be interesting for all of us. Yes.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting to know how many. The sooner they start forcing people to show their star rating, the better. Because I see also that you talk about the languages that information is available, but you don't mention any of the Chinese languages. Now, there's an awful lot of Chinese takeaways and restaurants, and I would imagine that you provide a service to those people in their own languages.
We've got the packs that they use and the places like the Chinese takeaways. There's something called Safe Food, Better Business Pack, and it's provided by the Food Standards Agency.
Yeah.
And on their website, places are able to download it in a variety of different languages, including Cantonese, Mandarin.
Yeah.
So all of the packs are set out in exactly the same way, so that when we're visiting, we know the layout and what should be in each area then. So we can look at a Cantonese pack and understand what they're looking at and what they're doing then with temperature records and things like that. So they do have information. That's good.
Thank you.
Thank you. Do we have any more questions on the service plan? No?
Well, Chair,
yes.
I'm just asking questions by all means.
Yes, of course you can. Yes.
I see on page 88 and it's coming back practically to a point that you made over there, and you're talking about the level of resources. Is sufficient to carry on? Now, your interpretation of sufficient to carry on and to carry out inspections, it depends. Your interpretation of sufficient would maybe be a wee bit different to my interpretation of sufficient, because my interpretation of sufficient is, well, you're getting by, you're managing, And I think that is a very, very important. I'm impressed very much, Chair, by the amount of work that is done within that department and the small number of staff that are there to actually do it. I think it is highly commendable that you're doing all that work and you're still producing these reports for us. I think it's quite amazing. I think your staff is to be congratulated, quite honestly. You're obviously working very, very hard. And sometimes these hidden phrases, it draws our attention to the fact that you really are under a lot of pressure. And if we don't pick up these points at the bottom, there is an actual fact where you have a breakdown of your staff when you talk about staff development. And I see, I can't remember where it is, but about someone who is on a 12-month secondment. Now that really does, that detracts from the number of staff that you've actually got there. And I wondered actually, because we do hear quite a lot about apprenticeships nowadays, and sometimes you can have a lot of difficulty in actually getting environmental health officers. I know how difficult that can be, and very difficult to actually retain them. And I wondered if we have ever actually considered having apprentices, because these are one of the things that are actually promoted as being good for business. And I wonder, have you considered looking at providing apprenticeship schemes? We do have a lot of very good high schools in the area, and to have some of these pupils coming straight from school into an apprenticeship for the Borough Council would be a great thing, both for the Borough Council and for the people in the area. Have you ever considered that, or would you actually consider it? I think, you know, that perhaps, as I say, you're scraping by the number of people you have to work for you. Can that be given some form of consideration?
Yeah, I agree. The difficulty comes with environmental health officers. We have to be competent to do the skills So there's a body called the CIEH that govern environmental health officers then, and the criteria that we need to meet to become competent in our jobs. They've had a whole host of different ways of doing this over the years. The two graduates that we've got at the moment, they've both done degrees, and then they've got to do a portfolio of professional practice then on top of that, as well as professional interviews and professional exams to become an environmental health officer. So it's a long process.
Yes.
I know that the CIEH is looking at apprenticeship programmes, but we'd have to have someone that's coming through an approved programme then to be able to come to and work with our department. I think it's also thinking about the time that would be involved in training up that,
that
person too, because as you said, we are a very small team. It's something that we definitely would, you know, would want to be involved in if we could do that. But I think it's having the capacity in the team to make sure that it worked both for the apprentice and for the team then, so that we're getting best for everyone.
Thank you, Gillian.
Through the chair, just, I think the other comment I would make is, as members will be aware, we now made decisions, you've made decisions about moving forward with a shared leadership team arrangement with Chase District Council. The expectation is that in services like this, that the services would become more resilient because you're basically hopefully able to recruit and retain to a larger pool of staff. So the ability to basically plug in and play staff from the two teams into different specialist areas, we are hopeful, A, that we'll recruit and retain staff more effectively, but as importantly, that we'll be able to deliver the service consistently and with that higher level of resilience. That certainly when dealing with, you know, staff numbers of the order of scale that we have here, if one or two were to leave, then we'd certainly notice it. But in the event that we've got that additional capacity and support from the office of the County Chase, that would certainly assist.
Okay. So we are a scrutiny committee, and I think we've scrutinised with the help of Councillor Loughran. We've got some answers that weren't in the report, which I think we can take away and certainly is food for thought. Thank you. Okay, can we now please move on to health and safety? And Neil, I believe you're on again.
So this is, I'll try and be good with this one, Chair. What this report reflects is the council's role, again, colleagues in the environmental health team, whose role it is to ensure the health and safety of people in the borough, whether that's residents or visitors to the borough, to ensure they're not adversely affected by the work or activities undertaken by businesses or employers. So essentially, our job is to support the health and safety executive. So colleagues will have heard of the health and safety executive, they're an agency of government, and they deal with large-scale and complex health and safety matters in the workplace. But local authorities like ourselves are the first port of call for lower-level sort of interventions. So what this report highlights is that in accordance with the HSE requirements, we produce an annual service plan. Sorry, 3-year service plan, an annual report, and an action plan. You'll see in the body of the report that there's certainly one of the tables that I'm going to fess up and volunteer a comment that when I read the report, it puzzled me, so I'll draw attention to it. It's on page 97. So you'll see there that there's an overview there that describes the capacity of the team and the resources we have available in this area of work. And again, we calculate this, it's approximately two full-time equivalent members of staff. And then look at the table which tells me there's over 2,000 known establishments. And in the next column it says the number of inspections taken is one. Yeah. And that sort of jumped out.
I thought it was a misprint.
But you see further along the columns there, number of service requests is 214, and number of accidents reported is 78. Now, what this highlights is that if you turn onto the next page, inspections and service requests, gives you a flavour there of the kinds of things that we're involved in and the approaches we adopt. Generally speaking, certainly in the post-COVID or COVID and post-COVID era, Health and Safety Executive has discouraged councils from going in too assertively or proactively into the business community. It's more about us reacting and responding to any issues as they arise. So what you see there is a summary of kinds of approaches that vary from face-to-face visits, some are online inquiries or complaints, but a lot of it's dealt with on a sort of desk basis. The one investigation that referred to there, my understanding is, Jill, that was at a scale and of a nature that's reportable to the Health and Safety Executive, so that's why that one's highlighted. That's not to say that we've only dealt with one inspection in the whole year. It's an inspection of the nature and scale, order of scale, that the Health and Safety Executive is interested in. So that's the report, Chair. Happy to answer any questions.
Okay. I had obviously read this report as well, and on page 97, which you've just highlighted, it was very interesting to me that the team relies or uses local intelligence. I know people are quick to complain, but I find it not shocking but surprising that you only have two full-time members of staff.
Again, we're in the conversation we just had about capacity. What we have is a multidisciplinary team, so the sort of staff in Jill's team basically support this area of work, food safety, environmental protection, noise complaints and so on and so forth. So the multi-skilled officers. That's why when you see reports of this nature where it refers to two full-time equivalents, effectively we're taking arms and legs of multiple members of staff to get to that number. We're all doing a little bit of a mixed bag of work.
I know how many complaints I get each week via the telephone. I'm being accosted in the street, so goodness knows what it must be like for your department. You must be taking calls all the time.
It's busy.
Yeah, I can imagine that's... right, okay.
Tony.
Thank you, Chair. The statement there, and you referred to this, is that the HSE guidance says that proactive inspection can no longer be used. Well, first of all, do they give a justification for saying this? And secondly, if it's only guidance, surely that means that it's the decision is up to the department?
I think it could be interpreted that way. I think this is part of an agenda which is about releasing business, particularly small businesses, from the burden of red tape. So I think it's a combination of, you can look at it from this perspective, you can look at it from the food inspection perspective, from a planning perspective,
over a number of years. I think it's fair to say that policies have been introduced and guidance have been introduced nationally that has expected of local authorities that we play more of a supportive and enabling role in respect to small business rather than going in with perhaps a red tape and bureaucracy and adopting perhaps a more assertive approach. We may have a different view as to whether we should or shouldn't, but we follow the guidance, Chair.
Thank you. Andy?
Yeah, that's my understanding that there's been a shift of emphasis. Wrong. To put more onus on businesses to make sure that they comply. So, as a result of that, if there's anything that goes wrong, the fines and the prison sentences that follow are considerably higher than there would have been if it was down to somebody else to police them, as it were. What I'm aware that the HSE's got more powers than the police. Have you got similar powers to the HSE as a local authority? Or are you sort of secondary to that? At what point do you, the HSE come in or the local authority come in on an investigation?
There's different types of places that are to do with local authorities inspection and investigation there and HSC. So with certain care homes, if the focus on a care home is to it's more assisted living and there's not any nursing care, it would be local authority that would inspect that for health and safety issues. If it was more nursing care and palliative care, then it would be HSC. So there's fine lines between things there. And it's the same through a whole host of different businesses there. There's a list on the HSC website of who does what then, with the local authority or themselves.
Right, okay, thank you.
Well, certainly, Chair, your earlier point is absolutely right. The onus is increasing on business, and certainly I'm aware from colleagues and ex-colleagues and friends who run their own businesses that the ISO standard, is it 14,001? Yeah, 14,001. Most businesses who interact with one another expect each other to hold that level of certification to demonstrate their understanding, awareness and their responsibilities. And as you say, when you look at the penal sentences now that are available for directors of businesses, then pretty severe.
Through you, Chair, that's the case with the standards, because of business target standard needs to deal with other businesses with the standards.
Absolutely.
And those businesses want qualifications from their own trade processes, which they have to have. So that's why I think there's been a shift in the emphasis on the business rather than the policing of it.
Thank you, Andy. Does anyone else have any questions? Okay, thank you very much, both of you.
Thank you.
So we move on to item number 7D, which is Emma. Thank you, Emma. Okay, would you like to take it away, Emma?
Yeah, in terms of the book view report, I wasn't going to draw members' attention to very much, but I wanted to give a brief overview of key budget assumptions. So the budget report as it stands is the, I must point out, this is the pre-second of position. So this is the budget that went on the 1st of December and we didn't get the trickle local government finance second until the 19th of December. And we're currently working through those budget figures now to see what that looks like post the settlement.
I hope you didn't work all the way through Christmas, Emma.
So in terms of what you have, we've got the key assumptions are, in terms of pay, we've had to include a pay provision of £1,925 per spinal column point, and then we've got 4% in for the following year and 2% for the next 2 years. And we've also reflected what we believe inflation on contracts is likely to be in January. So we've estimated 10% for the January, so that's had an increase. Obviously, the savings exercise that's also been undertaken.
Emma, can I just stop you? Which page are you actually on now? I'm sorry to interrupt you.
Okay,
then.
I'm on the agenda item. I'm just giving
right.
a brief overview about the assumptions.
sorry to have interrupted.
And then in terms of the actual report itself, obviously the other key thing to draw attention to is obviously this reflects the budget savings and they're identified in a separate table within the report. So I'm happy to go through each report separately. Those are room if any members have any questions.
Okay. Would you like to do that then?
Yeah.
And if anyone does have any questions, will you just raise your hand? Well, oh, Tony, go on.
Well, just a question on page 102.
Yeah.
So paragraph 5-6, just explain what a reduction in the underspending overhead budget system.
So these are in terms of the exercise that officers undertook, it's to have a look at where that budget is not routinely spent. So is there stuff that we've got in there that we don't actually need? So that was one of the exercises they did. So it's just it's a bit like, there could be a little bit on car allowances, a little bit on equipment. So it's bits and pieces of budget, but actually when you put them all together, actually make a more significant number.
And in on all for themselves wouldn't represent themselves on the report.
Page 103,
so we've got any questions? Chair.
Yes.
If you don't mind, please, Chair, I have a question, and it is. It begins in page 102, but it goes on for a couple of pages. We're in 5.8, and I know that for our work programme, we are about to have a report on the Disability Facilities Grant, but I want to comment on this. Because in 5.8, we're told that the Disabled Facilities Grant allocation is a vindictive allocation at this stage, pending further details on the value allocated. You can all read it for yourself. That was the first thing that my attention was drawn to. And then on page 104 and 105, there doesn't seem to be any mention whatsoever of a disabilities facility grant expenditure for 2022-23. And I think they normally do. I mean, we've got all these other things where under the community portfolio, where we've got, for example, you've got homelessness and housing rights, you've got water streets, you've got the private sector housing, all of these areas we have been told of the outcome for 2022-23. No mention whatsoever about the Disabilities Facilities Grant.
I know that Emma's got an answer for you.
Through you, Chair, it's actually the capital allocation, so that's on the capital programme. So it's on page 108.
Oh yes, I was coming to page 108,
yeah.
Did you believe?
so there isn't, the Disabled Facilities Grant is a capital budget rather than a revenue budget. So the first pages take you through the revenue changes, and then the appendix for capital is on page 108, which has the...
And I'm going to be told about any expenditure or any spends for Disability Facility Grant for the past year?
So for 2022-23, we're forecasting £1 million spend of that budget on page 108.
So, yeah, but I can see we're going to be spending £1 million there.
I'm spending currently.
Yeah.
You are spending?
Currently,
yeah.
And where are we going to
spend? So the first column is this year.
Yes, yes.
Next year we're spending
3.56.
We should be amazing achievement if we actually achieve that, because we've not achieved that in many of the years, which is why we're bringing the service in-house.
And
there is an amount of latent demand sitting there. We have already begun setting up the operation to bring the works in-house to try and smooth the transfer as much as we possibly can.
Have you spent any money at all on Disability Facilities Grant
this year? We anticipate spending £1 million.
That is for 2022-23, I'm assuming.
Yeah, that's this year.
And yeah, that is until presumably April of this year.
Yeah.
And you will have spent most of that £1 million, I would hope.
I would hope we'd spent all of it, because actually there are people out there and in the system who need this funding. Having said that, we're reliant on a third party who is losing their contract.
Yes.
That provides itself a number of challenges. If we do get to £1 million, I'd be delighted. But you can see that our intention is to ramp up demand to meet the latent demand that's sitting there. But at the same stage, we wrote a policy about 18 months ago, which also increases the number of people we can give grants to.
Yes.
We don't want to pick that up at this moment in time because there'll be potentially a capacity issue. If you build an expectation on top of a poorly performing service, then I think the real danger is the whole lot falls over and you achieve nothing. And so I think it's a delicate and balancing job. I expect to get to the £1 million.
Yeah, and the sorry to you,
that's all right.
The cabinet member, you can assure me that, that most of that money has been spent. You can find out where it's been spent.
You mean individual homes or
sorry? No, just you know, sort of in general terms, how are you spending the money?
I'm sure we could give you a we could give you a breakdown of that. Having said that, this is coming to committee in March at the chair's request. To look at the setting of the service. I'm sure we will share that information at that stage.
Right. Thank you, Chair. So we will be getting that information on that.
Absolutely.
It seems to have been an item that we've looked at every meeting and it's not a penny spent.
Oh, no, the money is being spent. It's just, it's not within our control.
Yeah.
And this is a county-wide issue in the main because six of the district and boroughs sign up to the current service, but it hasn't delivered for us over a number of years. I think we would have taken these actions several years ago if COVID hadn't come in at the time.
Yeah, I just worry that the money just doesn't disappear, Chair. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you.
If the money disappeared, it wouldn't be to anywhere within the Borough Council, so I think we're all on the same page. You know, there is a demand out there, there is a need out there.
Yes.
And you know, to be honest, I'd like to have been spending more money for many years before now.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. I think the other important thing to say is it is ring-fenced to DfG, so we cannot spend it on anything else.
That's also reassuring, Chair. Thank you.
Right, thank you. Any more questions for Emma?
Or community.
Yes. Page
110.
Anne,
will you just hang on just until we get on to that? Are we finished on?
Yeah.
Okay. So if we move on now to the environment portfolio, the general fund revenue budget, Anne, if you would like to ask your question of Emma.
It was just on 10.6. It says streets in efficiencies. Efficiencies bed and flares, efficiencies in bereavement. I'm just wondering what that meant.
I think it's the modern word for redundancies, isn't it?
This realised having some extras, but in terms of street scene, it's reviewing the rounds and reviewing how they actually undertake the stuff, so we can do it in a more efficient way than we've currently got. And then the bedding flowers we've talked about. Not buying in as opposed to growing our own, and we can get some efficiencies in that way. So a lot of these are actual true efficiencies in changing the way we do it as opposed to necessarily making redundancies.
So yeah. we're going back to the way we used to do it, mm-hmm. where we used to grow in-house.
This is buying them in, not growing less in-house and buying more in because it's cheaper in terms of the levels that we do it at this stage.
Okay.
I don't think we're necessarily getting rid of all of them. I think it's
also, I think through the chair, through the portfolio holders.
Do you want to come to the table?
Yeah, sure. Through the portfolio holders' involvement, we have also agreed to review the bedding areas and look at the higher profile areas like Victoria Park, but also consider in the less prominent areas whether we could substitute plant types, so we might move to shrubs in some areas rather than bedding plants.
So we're heading towards plants, shrubs that don't need as much maintenance.
But Chair, can I comment on the same page? We're obviously going to be in 2024 increasing the garden waste charge. We're not doing it this year because it's an election year. And I remember somebody saying over my dead body, would you increase the charge for the garden waste? But there it is there on page 110 in black and white. Increase garden waste charges from 2024. Well done.
through you, Chair, I think there was a long-standing commitment not to increase them in 2023.
Because there was an election, there you go. Would you believe it?
I can't believe that would be the case.
No,
I don't know what you're suggesting.
I just
well, you're a wee bit thick then.
It just concerns me that we're talking about efficiencies with Street Scene, and it was explained very clearly what that word meant at the last scrutiny committee I sat on as a substitute. And I think what we have to understand is that if we reduce the number of operatives working, we're relying on agency operatives, and a patch of grass that's not cut in 3 months is going to be twice as high in 6 months, therefore the job's going to take longer. We're talking about hanging baskets, which I personally believe Street Scene are doing an excellent job with, and there's more and more demand for hanging baskets. And I don't know, it just seems very higgledy-piggledy, and it worries me that we're cutting our finances, which it just doesn't add up. But, you know, we've got a beautiful borough, and in the summer it absolutely shines with the podium flowers, the parks. There isn't just Victoria Park in the borough. We've got quite a number of parks which are outstandingly beautiful, but I notice year on year they're not as magnificent as they used to be. And the types of plants that we're changing, nobody wants to see loads of bushes in a park, in a little pocket park, or even Victoria Park. They want to see flowers, and we need to have the operatives who know what they're doing. At the moment, we do have, and it concerns me that this is going to change.
I think, Chair, what I would say is the scale of the financial challenge, you as a group of elected members have to make difficult decisions and choices.
Yes.
And in service areas which are non-statutory, I mean, you just had a series of reports from a statutory service, environmental health, air pollution, etc., etc. This is a non-statutory area. It's a discretionary area of expenditure. And what we try to bring forward is a balanced suite of proposals that seek to minimise the visual impact. So we will look into the parks and gardens with a very close eye and try to minimise the impact. So to the naked eye, you wouldn't really notice the difference, but inevitably there will be some. And I don't think we should shy away from the fact that there are some reductions in service delivery in a way that perhaps you've seen it conventionally. But go back to what I said earlier, we've had to make some difficult choices or present information to members to make those difficult choices.
We have to think about mental and physical health with our green spaces and the beauty that we're giving. I don't want to sit on a park bench and stare at a bush when I could be sitting on a park bench looking at some magnificent flowers. Jeremy.
Thank you, Chair. I think we all understand the position the local government settlement year after year has put ourselves into. And to me, what is being described is a subtlety imbalance. You know, where the high footfall areas, where there are our green flag key parks, you know, those quite rightly should look as they do, which is part of our beautiful borough. But then there is lots of, I'm trying to think how many play areas we've got, where, you know, actually there are things in there where actually they aren't regarded in the same regard and in the same way. Mm-hmm. And I think it is exactly the right thing to do for us to review on an irregular basis what we're doing and where. And the opportunity that Neil's being able to do by coming in is to actually start some of those questions and make sure that those historic practices aren't hardwired into everything we do. And we've always got to spend the extra buck because, frankly, sometimes we don't need to do that. And in the circumstances we are, it is a tight environment and we have to do the best that we can for all of our residents. Mm. And looking at working practices as well as what we plant and where we plant them is also important. I think you are right that there are certain savings that don't end up as being savings, and we just need to make sure we don't fall into that trap. It's an iterative process. I'm sure we won't get it right. But equally, if there are businesses in our towns and villages who really value some of these things and actually want to invest in a hanging basket in, you know, their town centre, then we would welcome those conversations. If they want to sponsor a roundabout, it's done in other places. I don't think we should spend all our lives looking for people to sponsor everything, but if people want to proactively come out and do that to support us, which enables us to support those businesses, then we're willing to consider any of those opportunities.
Thank you. And we will be relying more heavily on volunteers and sponsorship. Ray.
Thank you, Chairman. Is it intended in the future to leave the grass at the side of the, particularly in the rural areas of the road, longer? And in fact, to environmentally, it's nice to see wildflowers growing rather than short. It's more environmentally friendly to see tall flower meadows at the side of the road. I think so anyway, and it would over a long term. It has to be financially beneficial for the borough.
Through the chair, those areas that you're highlighting, particularly the highway bridges. The responsibility of the highway authority.
Yeah,
as you rightly point out, they proactively, in some cases, actually planted wildflower seed in some of those verges to provide that sort of depth of colour and variety of species and improve the biodiversity of those kind of areas. Rather than being bold and green standard of cut, and that, I think you say that can actually add quality visually to that kind of location.
Absolutely, yeah.
Unfortunately, through experience, wildflowers only have a certain time that they can flower. They then become a thick brown mass, which is very unsightly. Carolyn.
Thank you. Back to your point about parks, if that's all right. It's just a little bit of information. Tony Dale told me only yesterday that Stonefield Park got, in the Green Flag Award, got the highest points possible, which is the best it's ever done this year. So when you said that you've seen it reduced, Stonefield Park, absolutely not.
That's the best
it's ever done.
Because we have a big body of volunteers who work in Stonefield Park.
The two new rangers there have really taken it on board as well. So I would like to sort of thank the two new rangers actually for taking it on as if it's their own. So
they are just absolutely brilliant. You're quite right, Kel.
Thank you.
Anne.
I was going to more reiterate what Councillor Sutherland was saying, and I was reading that Rochdale Council and Burnley Council have said that they're saving tens of thousands by planting wildflower verges. It says local authorities need to be leading the way, both by demonstrating good practice in their parks and verge management and by enthusing and helping local communities to take action themselves. And I think that the local communities are really keen to see wildflower verges. But it also says that they can save money for local councils, with Burnley Council saving tens of thousands of pounds each year. So it's really worth looking at.
Jeremy.
Thank you. Notwithstanding, it's still the Highways Authority's responsibility for roadside verges. And I'm sure you'd be delighted to reflect those comments to your local county councillor or alternatively to the county council. Direct.
But I
think it's a divisive issue because, you know, I often find half the committee love them and half the committee hate them.
Yeah.
Partly the reason the chair gave, but also partly because of visibility.
Yeah.
So it is a really divisive issue I found on the ground, notwithstanding what you've said. I do want to come back to the picking up the grass, because we do have areas we do mow ourselves that are the borough councils, and in principle there are some small areas today that we don't pick up the grass, but actually in many of the high profile areas people want the grass picked up, and it creates more of a problem by not picking it up, notwithstanding the environmental benefit of leaving grass to mulch and do all those sorts of things. And there is the not insignificant difficulty in terms of the additional capital costs that's required to go and change all your mowing fleets, and the cost of going doing that out up front. So I think we've got about the balance right with many of the radial areas where stuff is cut to make it look clean and tidy, but not sort of up at knee length. And then there are other areas, and those need mowing on a regular basis, because if you don't mow them on a regular basis, when you come to just cut it and leave it, it doesn't disappear, it doesn't mulch into the ground or anything else. So I think the working practices are right on balance at the moment. There is always things that we could do differently in specific areas, and if people have got a specific area that the borough does maintain that they're interested in, I'm sure we would consider that.
Thank you, Jeremy. Anne.
Thank you very much, Chairman. I just want to, Jeremy, can you clarify? I just thought that we did sponsor roundabouts, that people, that businesses did do put.
I'm offering the opportunity to do more.
yeah, I mean, I'm just thinking, actually.
You should help those businesses, obviously.
I'm a big believer. I mean, you go to Spain and places like that, and you go into small towns, and they've got beautiful roundabouts and lovely monuments on it and things like that. And I really do feel that we in Stafford, we don't make enough of our roundabouts. And I'm just wondering, some of these big businesses now that's coming into the area, whether, you know, they would put some money into doing something. You know, let's promote our area.
The only issue with putting a sponsorship sign on a roundabout is it then becomes liable for rates bills. So we have to pay rates then on the roundabout because it's got a sponsorship.
Well, I mean, some of the gateways into Stafford, it'd be lovely to see. I mean, you come down the Western Road and you see the Stafford knot on that roundabout.
Yeah.
If we could do that in other areas, you know, coming off the motorway and that, it's a thing of mine. I just feel that we don't do enough of it.
Andy.
Totally agree. I think it's a UK thing versus a European thing when you see these things. But I can hear the noise now. You started putting monuments on roundabouts. Have we got this kind of money to spend?
No, I'm not about businesses doing that. These big businesses.
Yes,
you know, like, is it Pet City that's going into that big building and what, Petsitome, yeah. And that is going to be their national distribution offices and everything. You know, surely they've got a few thousand quid that they can throw out in to roundabouts, something like that. It's worth asking.
Okay. Emma, do you want to continue?
So are there any further questions on the environment portfolio?
Chair, could I ask about the increase in the claims related expenditure for street scene? Page 114, Tosh Report 2, is going up to 79,080 pounds. I wonder why the street scene claims related expenditure is going to be.
It's the increase in energy prices that we've forecast. So at the moment we've reflected that the energy prices are likely to go up significantly. Yeah, so it's the gas bill effectively.
Thank you, Gia.
Anybody else? Any questions?
Well, can I ask you?
You can.
On page 115. The third party fee meets for CCTV here in page 115 towards the bottom, and it seems to be the outstanding for 2023 116,000, and then when you look at it, you know, it's going right down to 94. Why is that?
So this is one of the savings that's being put forward, which is a review of the CCTV aligned to the nighttime economy.
We are absolutely not turning any cameras off. It's just efficiencies made through camera monitoring that we're doing through improvements in technology. So we're absolutely not switching any cameras off whatsoever.
You're just going to look at the voice off?
No. Use technology.
Okay, Tony.
Page 120, the capital programme. I see that the replacement of green bins and blue bins, for that matter, we're looking at spending a substantial amount this year and next, but then it drops by, well, in the case of the green bins, about half, and in the blue bins even more. So why is that?
Through you, Chair, the 22, 23 and 23 four figures are slightly higher because they didn't spend the allocation in the previous year, so that includes a slippage into 22-23 and then into 23-24,
mm-hmm.
and then the 24-25 and 25-26 figures are then what the normal base level is. Obviously what we do is we review each year and then we look to see what the outturn looks like each year as to what we then need to look forward.
Okay. Anybody?
Jim, I was just going to comment on the page 124, the allotments.
Yep.
There does seem to be quite a substantial expenditure compared to the income. Or am I misreading that?
Do you want to read
through you, Chair? I think this was brought for one of the other community scrutinies, and it's partly a grant that we pay for the management of the allotments. So the allotment society manage all the. That's not the right name, but they manage all the allotments on our behalf. And I think there's also some other costs in there as well, because I think I looked at it actually in the scrutiny.
Do you feel the same thing as?
Yeah, so we pay them and they manage it, the whole lot for us. But there is some other costs in that surprise. We've got that whole amount.
And can I ask Mention, is the income solely from the allotment holders?
Yes.
It's a bargain, isn't it?
So shall we just go through this page by page then, because it's not huge. So we've got 121, 122, 123, 124, 125, 126, 127, 127, and the final page, 128. No? Okay. Thank you so much, Emma.
Report is noted, Chair.
Thank you, Councillor Sutherland. Andrew, would you like to present the work programme?
Yes, Chair. Thank you. The main part of the work programme is included on the very last page, on page 132, and our last meeting of the municipal year, scheduled meeting, is the 23rd of March, and you can see the items listed there. I'm happy to take any questions.
Does anyone want to ask Andrew anything about the work programme? I'm particularly pleased to see that the disabled facilities grants is at last on our agenda. Okay, sorry.
Yeah.
Oh, Councillor Pep.
Before you finish, Chair, it might be appropriate for us to introduce Christine.
Sorry, that was at the very end. But if you guys,
sorry, what's your name?
My name's Chris Forrester.
Hello, Chris.
I'm your new Head of Finance, I think, at Stafford, yeah. Head of Finance and Section 151 Officer.
You're not the interim officer.
No, I'm the
yes.
One.
We have one.
For many years.
Well, welcome, Chris. It's nice to meet you. Thank you. Okay, meeting's closed.